How do people respond to a God who is pictured as a judge of evil? Welcome to The Good Word. Once again, I'm Brant Berglund, your host this quarter, and with me are my conversation partners, Dave Thomas and Alden Thompson, professors of theology and Old Testament and church history here at Walla Walla University. Both have doctoral degrees, and so they're educated in this sort of field, and yet the Book of Revelation, I've spent a lot of time in it, and I feel like a real new person to it as well. So even having education doesn't mean we completely understand this very complicated book. But my opening question, how do people respond to a God who is pictured as a judge of evil?
Depends on which side of evil you're on. Yeah. In the Old Testament, it's very interesting. The picture of judge there, while often if we have the Western picture of a judge standing back looking to see whether we're guilty, in the Old Testament, the judge is much more like the prosecuting attorney. And somebody's been beating up on the widows, and he says, where are they? I'll go and I'll beat the tar out of them. So this idea of a judge of evil can bring great joy to those who are on God's side.
I would agree that it all depends on your relationship to evil. If evil is your stock in trade, then a God who destroys or judges evil is not going to be good news. But if evil is your enemy and you want to avoid it, then it's very good news.
Is there a sense in which people today ask the question, where is the judge of evil, right? When we think about awful atrocities happening, the innocent suffering, we think about war that kills people, and we think about tidal waves and tsunamis that take out innocent life. Where is the judge, right? Where is someone
stepping? Well, it's crying book of Revelation. The soul is out crying out from underneath the altar. You know, how long, O Lord?
Yeah, before you judge.
And I mean, the question of evil is an old one. It goes all the way back to Job, which we think is the oldest piece of writing in the Bible. So, I mean, our sense of justice and injustice is seriously offended by the existence of evil.
And our desire to see it rectified and,
yes,
and justice served.
Yes.
In chapters 8...
And we want that done in this life, not just in the life to come. If somebody suffers injustice, a neighbor, we want that fixed.
We want it done now.
Yeah,
absolutely. In chapters 8 and 9 in Revelation, we have seven trumpets that blow, and they actually carry on into chapter 10 and 11. The seventh trumpet shows up in chapter 11, and we have an interlude in chapters 10 and 11. But before this section begins, we have a sanctuary scene. That is a picture of angels before the golden altar of incense. And it says that the incense rises up to God, and mixed with the incense are the prayers of the saints. And so far in the book of Revelation, the prayers of the saints that we've seen are, Alden, what you mentioned. How long, O Lord, before you judge and avenge? And in response to the prayers of the saints, trumpets are given to seven angels, and they're to go out and blow them. And in the Old Testament, trumpets were blown on a number of occasions at the coronation of a king. A trumpet would be blown. A trumpet would be blown at, like, the fall of Jericho, right? They had to march around Jericho and blow trumpets. We also see trumpets blown not, I think, unconnected to this passage. We see trumpets blown on the feast of Rosh Hashanah, which was Jewish New Year. Trumpets were blown on the first day of the month of Tishri in the fall, and 10 days later, the Day of Atonement began. And the trumpets were blown as a warning that the great day of judgment was coming for Israel. Now, Alden, you already pointed out that judgment can be a very good thing, right? Dave, you felt like, yeah, if you're on the right side of evil, this is a good experience. For Israel, was the Day of Atonement good news or bad news?
You know, I would like to think that for them it was good news. It was a little scary for that day to come. But if you think about it, that's the day that in the Old Testament anyway, where sin, at least in symbol, is the camp is rid of sin. Okay, did you have a picture of the fact that now we have a new beginning and all of this has gone by? It's past. It's sent out into the wilderness.
Well, I think of a regular point in time where you can look forward to the ritual which marks the end of sin is helpful. It's not some general dread of what's going to happen. No, the liturgy takes you to this particular point, and we will take care of evil at this point.
Once and for all. And that's good news. The challenge here, though, is we don't have the Day of Atonement imagery quite yet in Revelation. Instead, we have the Ark of the Covenant scene in chapter 11, and here we only have the altar of incense, which is before the Ark, and the prayers of the saints are going up to God, and he is, it seems like maybe he is beginning to blow the trumpets announcing the great judgment. But what happened after he, after each angel blows the trumpet, is there appear to be scenes of judgment on the earth, but they're small scenes. Over and over in the first four trumpets, we see a third of this, of the sea, a third of the springs of water, a third of the earth. We don't see complete destruction. We have small judgments. Dr. John Pauline wrote his dissertation on the seven trumpets, really on just the first four trumpets. And in decoding them, he suggests that the blowing of trumpets on the Feast of Trumpets for Israel announced the coming of the great day of judgment, and that the, each one of these trumpets are mini judgments, maybe in history or maybe in personal experience as well, I wonder. But this is, and I will argue, one of the most difficult passages in Revelation, the next two chapters. We have a mountain that falls into the sea, and we have a fallen star, and we have bitterness. And then in the fifth trumpet, we have a locust plague coming up, and we have great armies going to war in the sixth trumpet. And it just appears that there are judgments happening on earth. I'm not going to go into a lot of the details here, but would you think it's possible that there have been events in history where God has stepped in and put an end to something that was so atrocious, so heinous, that God had to actually act? Can you think of times when maybe that has happened?
Well, it's more likely that we think of times when it hasn't happened. I think of the Nazis.
But I
the
think
Holocaust,
there are occasions.
Sure.
I think the flood is an example of that. I'm certainly willing to put the Holocaust on that list. It does seem like when people give themselves over to evil on a wholesale basis, that their longevity declines. In other words, they're not going to go on forever. That at some point they're going to either self-destruct or somebody will take them out. And so I like to think that I like that passage in Daniel where Daniel comes in to answer the king's dream, and he says that there is a God in heaven who knows the grand scope of things, and his hand is active in history. And those are my words, but I mean, that's the gist of that, that this is a God who has acted in history and continues to act in history. So to talk about partial judgments to rid the world of unbridled evil, that does not fly in the face of the God I think about.
And yet, Alden, you said that this is more complicated because there's times when we wonder if God would step in, and it doesn't appear that he does.
No.
Well, he doesn't step in the way we want him to.
Or as soon as we want.
Yeah.
How do you answer, or is there an answer? Is it best to be silent in the face of...
I sometimes wonder if God leaves evil alone so that it destroys itself.
Is evil self-destructive?
I think it can be.
Yeah. When John Pauline interpreted the seven seals or seven trumpets here, and he looked at the first four, he suggested that the first trumpet was the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and perhaps a little broader than that, but suggesting that first trumpet, that first judgment, was a judgment against those who, and it wasn't just Israel itself, it wasn't just Jewish people, but it was a judgment against those who had rejected the gospel message of Jesus Christ, the good news of Christ's coming. And in the end, rather than having their hearts converted to Jesus Christ, they revolted against Rome and brought upon themselves the end of the Jewish nation as a whole, not because of any anti-Semitism, but simply because the transforming power of Christ was not at work in them, right?
But I think it is a very sobering moment for humans when you realize that there's plenty of evidence in the Bible that God will not tolerate unbridled evil for very long.
That God actually has an end in mind.
Yeah, that God will act to against evil.
Well, Sodom and Gomorrah is another example. Dave, you mentioned the flood earlier.
Yeah.
But those are two vivid examples where the Lord has said, because in Sodom and Gomorrah, you couldn't even walk into the town without being molested.
Mm-hmm. And the flood language is the thoughts of their heart were only evil continually.
Yeah.
At some point, is it possible that divine mercy runs out and God is actually asked to act like a judge simply in defense of his people?
I think that in the love of God, we misunderstand it. It's like the love of a mother bear. You know, that if you mess with her children, she will come at you. But unfortunately, the bear will come in anger. I think God will come with deliberateness. He won't allow it to. It'll only allow it to go to a certain point.
And we'll talk otherwise, later on in Revelation about this, because God's character and how he deals with evil is unique. And we already talked about how the Lamb overcomes. He doesn't overcome through conquering with swords and warfare tanks. He comes with self-sacrifice. How will that end evil? This is a question that I have, and I'm looking forward to how we answer it. In the last couple minutes that we have, I'd like to skip to chapter 10 very quickly. And the Sabbath school lesson for the quarterly doesn't spend as much time on some of the passages as I'd like. But there in chapter 10, we see an angel who has a little scroll rather than the scroll of chapter 5. And now he has a little scroll that once was sealed and now is opened. And Adventist scholars have, in our history, suggested this little scroll was the book of Daniel. The Adventist church very much self-identified with the experience here of John, who eats the little book, much like Ezekiel did back in chapters 2 and 3 of Ezekiel. The angel gives John the book and says, eat it, it'll be sweet in your mouth, but bitter in your stomach. Ezekiel's experience, if we compare it, that book was sweet in his mouth. It wasn't bitter in his stomach, but the prophecy he had to give to Israel was certainly bitter, as was his experience. What does it mean for a prophet when they're told you have to go again and prophesy to people who have already rejected the message once, and you have to go again? John is told at the end of chapter 10, go again. Is that a good experience?
Well, I had one man, in fact, was troubled because the Adventists see this as the return of the 1844 message. You must go and prophesy again. But there is a sense in which I think this brother was right, that this is John's call to ministry, and it wasn't necessarily a happy time.
Yeah, certainly so, John. And I'm wondering if John here, is John like Ezekiel? Is he a type or a symbol of something more? Because it certainly reflects John's second calling and Ezekiel's. And then Ezekiel had to go prophesy again to Israel.
Yeah, I mean, prophesying is tough enough when you do it the first time. The second time, I think you'll get your ears boxed.
Except for Jonah.
Yeah.
Yeah, except for Jonah.
That's good news.
He got his ears boxed the first time.
In chapter 11, we see the two witnesses, and perhaps we'll have time to talk about that next week. But our time is just about up for today. I encourage you to go back and study the seven trumpets on your own and prayerfully look at some commentaries on that, and encourage you to look at those in the context of small judgments of God. Good news, though. God will bring an end to evil. Thank you to Dave, and thank you also to Alden for conversing with me today. Thank you to Jared Miller, our sound engineer, for helping make this listenable each week. And thank you to you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.